Sorry for our late beginning. So we're talking about love. Love that's inherited.
What page?
Chapter 18. Chapter 18 would be
75.
46 if you look at the numbers on top. 76 in the Hebrew, 75 in the English. We're talking about love. We're talking about the ability for us to have an emotional connection to Hashem and to Judaism. And Alter Rebbe is saying it's inherited. And that seems to make no sense. How could you inherit love? I might love something. My children don't love it. Okay, who says you're going to be able to pass on your passions, your loves, your hobbies? Does Zadie like Frank Sinatra? The next generation love Bruce Springsteen? I don't even know who they love today. It's no connection. It's different generations, different times. We're talking about something that's supposed to last 3,700 years from the times of Rambam, you know. What does that mean? How can that be? So the Alter Rebbe said that the answer is it's genetics, in as many words, even though he didn't have that kind of language available to him. And he said it's a Yerusha, it's an inheritance. And he said even though we only talk about love, he said the fear, the awe of Hashem is included in that as well. What in heaven does that mean? So we began this already, and I'm just going to recap so we can move seamlessly into the subject as we map out the Jewish genome. The thing is that the Avos are called the Merkava. That's the name, that's the terminology that our sages use to describe the spiritual achievement and the level of the Avot, of the patriarchs. So a Merkava is a chariot in its most literal iteration, or a vehicle. And the nature of a vehicle is that a vehicle simply goes where its rider takes it. The vehicle does not have a mind of its own. What does this mean? Well, there is another place that used the terminology Merkava, and that was in the vision of Ezekiel. He saw the various angels who were carrying, as it were, in the euphemism, in the anthropomorphical description, a chariot. And there's various angels that are carrying this chariot. In God's presence, if you will, kaviyachol, it like sits on this chariot and is being carried by the Merkava, which is comprised of Seraphim, Oifanim, and Chayis HaKedesh. It's a different terminology for angels than I'm going to leave alone for right now. So that's how it is in the heavenly, in the spiritual realms. In the material realm, in this world, who carries the presence of Hashem? You say the Jewish people, but really it's the Avos who serve as the Merkava. The Avos serve as the Merkava for God's presence here in this world. And that's why the Avos are called Merkava. That's why they're called. Because the great Tzaddikim, they actually carry the presence of Hashem on earth. So just as we say on high, in a spiritual realm, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is able to be carried or communicated or conveyed or transported through a means of particular angels, on earth it's through neshamas, it's through souls. And we know that souls are even greater than angels. As it's written that Tzaddikim, that the greatest of tzaddikim are greater than Malachi Asharis, than the ministering angels. So that's why we say that the Avos, not only the Merkava, but it's brought down elsewhere that the Avos are Iker HaMerkava, the primary Merkava. In other words, the Merkava in heaven, that's a secondary Merkava. The real Merkava is Hashem's presence on earth, and that's carried through the great tzaddikim. There's an incredible Drasha Saran, where the Ran explains that the Beis HaMikdash was the seat, the vehicle, the repository of the Shekhinah. So therefore, because it was the repository of the Shekhinah, a person could come to the Beis HaMikdash, and if they were sensitized, they would be able to connect. Because the Shem's presence was there in a more pronounced way. And the Ran goes on to say the same is true with regard to tzaddikim. A tzaddik is like a mini Beis HaMikdash, if you will. Just as the Beis HaMikdash functioned in that purpose, the tzaddik functions in that purpose. And he says, after tzaddikim pass on, then that's the case with their resting site. And that's, of course, why Chevron is so important. Chevron is the epicenter of all prayers. All prayers are beamed through Chevron. From Chevron, they come on high. The Avos are the ones who bring all the prayers. The Avos are the ones who connect us to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Not only once upon a time, but this is an ongoing reality. Now, this notion of Merkava, the way we explain it, insofar as Avodas Hashem is concerned, the service of God is concerned, we say that the Avos dedicated every fiber of their being to the service of Hashem. There wasn't a single hair out of place. Everything they did was done with absolute holy intention. There was no time when their own selfishness, when their own self-desires were able to overcome. Are you going to say the Avos could have made a mistake? Yeah, but that's not an evil thing. The Avos made a well-meaning mistake, perhaps. Yitzchak thought that Esau was the man. But in fact, he found out later that Yaakov is the man. And how do we know this? Because a normal person who puts so much effort into a particular project and then sees it goes up in smoke, what's it going to be his reaction? He's going to be angry. How could you do that to me? But for Yitzchak, it was never about himself. It was always about Hashem. And the moment he saw that Yaakov was supposed to get the blessings, like yesterday's parsha, what did he say? The moment, without even any kind of interregnum, there's no even, let me think about this. He said, Gam Baruch Yeh. Why? Because Yitzchak Avinu was totally devoted to Hashem. With 100% absolute dedication and devotion, not even a question. And because he's totally devoted to Hashem, so therefore everything that's connected to the will of Hashem, that was the will of Yitzchak. He had no will on his own. And so it was with the Avos. All of the Avos. And the Emoris, really. So the notion that they were, that they sanctified themselves, that they committed themselves, that they dedicated themselves, and I would add, without having any precedent, without having Matan Torah, without having Avos to look back at, without having a sweep of history to be part of, on their own. This is, you know, the hearing about a Jewish people that will rise up and change the world. You're one person. In a world that mocks and laughs at everything you're doing. And yet, the Avos were absolutely devoted and committed, and they never even questioned. So because of this, says the Alter Rebbe, because the Avos, hein hein hamerkava. So Al-Kain, therefore, zochu lahamshich nefesh ruach neshama, livnehem achareihem ad olam. Therefore, they merited to bring forth a nefesh, a ruach, and a neshama. These are three different levels. They're not the same. Three different levels. Livnehem achareihem, for their children, after their terrestrial lifetime ends, the children that will be born for the future, ad olam, for eternity. Now we know that as a rule, there's something called isarusa de lasata, which brings about isarusa de la'ela. Freely translated, when you reach out, HaKadosh Baruch Hu reacts. There was an awakening from below, and the awakening from below engenders and elicits an awakening from on high. That means the more a person toils in Avedas Hashem, the more he or she can expect some kind of reciprocity. Hashem reaches out back to you. And there's a dynamic over here. This is also known in English as relationship. We're in a relationship with God. And when in a relationship, there's a dynamic where one side necessarily affects the other. There's a to and a fro, you know? There's a symbiosm, and there's also a reactionary kind of thing. You know, you serve the ping pong, it's hit back to you. There's back and forth. We're not in a monologue with God, even though it feels like a monologue, that we're talking to the walls. That's what it feels like when we daven. But the truth is that Hashem is waiting for us to reach out to Him. As one sofer once explained to me, he said, why are we so careful to check our mezuzahs and our tefillin before Rosh Hashanah? He said, and what if your tefillin and mezuzahs were fine? So was it a waste? You went and checked it. You spent the money. You had the toil and the bother of taking all the mezuzahs down and then cataloging them to know which mezuzah goes where. You take it to the sofer. And in fact, everything was kosher. So it was a waste. Baruch Hashem.
And it's expensive.
Huh?
And it's expensive.
And it's expensive. Yeah. So he said to me that there's this idea that a Yid is trying to come closer to Hashem. The fact that a Yid takes pains to check his mezuzahs, to show that he cares, to show that he's worried and has some kind of holy anxiety, are my mezuzahs good or not, that in and of itself elicits a response from Hashem. It makes sense? He said to me also, like, people want to get a nicer pair of tefillin, but the parshiot should be written more beautifully. What difference does it make? Is it kosher or is it not kosher? Is it kosher or not? There's no half kosher, three quarters kosher. Can be a little bit pregnant. Either you got the mitzvah tefillin or you didn't get the mitzvah tefillin. So he said to me, it's true. But when a Yid does a mitzvah behider, which is sometimes mistranslated as meticulously, really means beautifully. You do a mitzvah beautifully. He says, then when you go out of your way to do that extra mitzvah in a more beautiful fashion, that engenders a similar kind of response. Because when you get into the details, that shows love. It's not just, as they say in Yiddish, you did what has to be done, but you don't really care about what you're doing. You demonstrated that you really care about this. So it becomes a labor of love. When it becomes a labor of love, then Hashem responds in kind. And so it is with all of Yiddishkeit. There's this to and fro, there's this relationship thing that's going on between us and Hashem.
Isn't there a relationship all the time, even if you're not paying attention to it?
Of course there's a relationship all the time. When you ignore your wife, how does it go? She ignores you. How do you like that?
That's a nice relationship.
Is that good?
Is it good?
Yeah.
Not quite.
Okay, so same thing to Hashem. A Yid ignores Hashem, he might get ignored back. As we read in the Hayom Yom last week, that the early Hasidim used to say, Hab Halta Yidin, that the HaKadosh Baruch Hashem is Baruch Dir Haltabim. Show love for a fellow Yid, Hashem will show love for you. And so on and so forth. And the interesting thing is that because we are Hashem's children, the way you treat another Yid ultimately is the way Hashem treats you. Not just the way you treat God. It's the way you treat another Yid.
It's the little children.
Right? Hashem's children. Love what the lover loves. Hashem loves his children, you have to love the children. It's a little unsettling, right? It's much easier for people to worship God. You want to hear about people. Ah, people are miserable, rotten. I'll get them back for what they did. Oh, Hashem! That was another story. But you know, the luchot were given two separate tablets, and they're equal in size and weight. The point is that the mitzvahs between Adam Lamokim, Adam Lachavere, the mitzvahs that govern the relationship, with the currency of the relationship between us and our fellow human, and the currency of the relationship between us and God, which are both of them are supposed to be spiritually oriented, they're both equally important. And you can't ignore one and focus only on the other. People say, well, I'm a good person. You think about God? Oh, no, who has time for that? I'm busy being a good person. Well, you got half right. Or the other person says, I think about God all day. How about humanity? I could care less about them. I'll kill them all. I don't care. As long as my path to heaven is clear. Clearly, that guy's missing the point as well. So bottom line is, when you do something extraordinary, Hashem responds in kind. There's a beautiful story told that the Baal Shem Tov was told by Achia Shileni about his neshama in its previous iteration. He said that there was once, I think it was Eliyahu HaNavi saw from heaven this incredible light that radiated from northern Israel, from Tzfat. And it turned out, Eliyahu HaNavi investigated, and that this person had done something extraordinary on the day of his bar mitzvah. And because of that, he was bathed in some kind of incredible spiritual glow. So Eliyahu HaNavi comes to the person in a dream, and he says, please tell me what you did on your bar mitzvah. And if you do, I promise you, Gili Eliyahu, I will come and teach you Torah. And the simple person said, what I did for Hashem alone. I never told a soul, and I'm not telling you either. And he refused to tell Eliyahu HaNavi. Can you imagine? This is the simplicity of the Yid. And the Yid refused any kind of pressure from Eliyahu HaNavi, that he refused to divulge what he did in his bar mitzvah. And Achia Shalini said, that was your neshama in the previous Gilgul, in the previous iteration. So the point, of course, is that he did something, whatever he did, and because he did something, there was this wondrous reaction. He created something about him. It was something real.
Maybe he shared it with all the other. Maybe he would lose that too. Maybe lose that glow.
I don't know. This the stories could be analyzed now. What he should have done, what he shouldn't have done. Bottom line is, this is the story that this is what I read. You know, I don't know anything more than what I read.
But he held fast to his principle.
Yeah, he held fast to his principle of Hatzna Leches, of being discreet with Hashem. And that's an incredible thing. It's a remarkable thing.
So it's Mida Keneged
Mida. Mida Keneged Mida. Exactly the point. You know, there's a story of a guy whose name was, if my memory serves you correct, his name is Bar Ketzutzia. And it's a crazy story. A story it's in time of the Gemara. A story about a person who was very wealthy, and he fell in love with a married woman, and he was pressuring her, and she was trying to be righteous. No, he made all kinds of advances, nothing to talk about. And in the end, her husband fell into very hard times, and she desperately needed a loan. And she came to this guy and said, I need to save my husband. And he said, no problem, I can take care of you. Bar Ketzutzia said, but we have a deal. So she said, okay, what should I do? I have to save my husband. She got the money, she redeemed her husband from jail, and Bar Ketzutzia came to claim his bounty. And she said to him, look, I can't say no, it's over, whatever. So, but think about it, like it has to be a moment of pleasure here on earth. You're going to have eternal shame. You're going to have eternal shame. Really? You really want to do this? Nobody could imagine the pressure, the taiva. And he, in the end, he said, okay, forget it. We're going to do what's right. And he was not an observant fellow. He said, we're going to do what's right. And he left her. The story is told, Rabbi Akiva sees at the window a guy riding on a horse. And he calls over his talmidim. He says, bring that guy here right now. He said, there's not a... Bring him here right now. He says to him, what's your name? He says, Bar Ketzutzia. He says, then tell me what you did in life. He says, you're bathed in a holy light. You did something in life. And the guy said, talk, I didn't do anything. I'm a low life, trust me. And Rabbi Akiva pressured him, and they started to go over the details, and he told him this story. Rabbi Akiva said, you have been given an extraordinary spiritual aptitude because of your Mesiras Nefesh, because you didn't commit that sin. He said to him, stay with me, I will make you a great man in Israel. And Bar Katsutzia left his business holdings, folded up his life, became a Talmud of Rabbi Akiva, and the Gemara finished the story, this finishes, and this is the person we call Mar Ukva. A teacher of the Gemara, one of the sages, one of the Tanaim. So what happened? What happened was he had an act of Mesiras Nefesh, and because he had an act of Mesiras Nefesh, something changed. He was given something in exchange. This is the way we believe. If somebody does something extraordinary for Hashem, there is a reciprocity. As we say, the Eibishter Bleibt Nishka B'Chayiv, God does not remain in debt, and every act of Mesiras Nefesh, every act of holiness, every act of dedication and loyalty and devotion is ultimately recompensed. And here's the beautiful part. Because Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov was so remarkable, because they were so challenged, because they had nothing, nobody to learn from, and yet they managed to hallow and sanctify themselves down to the milli detail and live their whole life like that. Zachu l'hamshich. They were able to bring forth nefesh, ruach, neshama, not all three. Not nefesh, ruach, neshama. Nefesh, ruach, neshama. You'll see later, it's one of the three. Livneim achareim adelim. So this is divine reciprocity, not just to them, but to their descendants. In other words, the patriarchs and the matriarchs earned this. Our antecedents earned this. And because they earned it already. We are reaping the benefits. So one might say that we are just here to get what they did for us. Yeah, that's true. That's true. As a famous politician who I don't like much said, you didn't build this. We didn't build this. We didn't. And that's why we say, B'mkem g'day l'mal talmid. Don't even think that you can stand in the place of Rav Yitzchak. You have no idea. We can't even imagine who they were. Far beyond our imagination. And there's nothing more despicable, I find, than people who write these ridiculous books and stories mocking the others or putting them into some kind of typical, ordinary, mundane light, and as if they're one of ours. It's like, you know, we can relate. It's the biggest chil Hashem. It's the biggest denigration of holiness. So the holy avos who transform themselves, because they transform their corporeal reality, that's why they were able to bring forth these holy souls for all of their progeny until the end of time, which of course includes converts, as a convert is known as Ben Avraham and Bat Sarah. Now here, there's an obvious question that kind of rises. I'm sure you've heard this idea that Neshamas Yisrael Kadmu La'olam, that the souls of Israel preceded the nature of creation. Avraham Avinu is only born 1,948 years into creation. So, and then Avraham Avinu, and you have Yitzchak, and you have Yaakov. We have basically 2 centuries of remarkable spiritual achievement. Now we're talking about almost 1,300 years into creation. So if it's 1,300 years into creation, and you're telling me that they created these souls, they brought forth these souls, what about the idea that Neshamas Yisrael existed? Or it says, like, primordial years or eons before the world is created. How do you square that? How does that work?
So it's good in hand.
Yeah. Right. So the answer is twofold. Number one, yes, there was a concept of Neshamas Yisrael, but it wasn't necessarily going to be married to the children of Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. There was Neshamas Yisrael. They were called Neshamas Yisrael. Even Yaakov wouldn't have a name Yisrael originally. And the question is, who's going to get those souls? The soul is there. Who gets it? Number one. Number two, there could be a spiritual reality of the soul. The question is, does that spiritual reality can have any kind of bearing or impact in a corporeal, physical existence of a human being? Because once the Neshama gets down here, the forces of darkness and concealment are so intense that, you know, you have a great Neshama, but it doesn't go anywhere. Well, what's the perfect example of that? Yesterday's Parsha, Esav, had a huge Neshama, bigger than Yaakov's, more potential than Yaakov. Where did it go? Went nowhere. It could have, but it didn't. And here we're saying that ultimately, once a Yid has Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, ultimately, it's there. The Neshama is there, and it may show up at the strangest of times. You never know when it's going to reveal itself. So this is the meaning of Zachu l'hamshich. They were able to draw forth. And they bring forth this Naran, Nefesh Ruach Neshama, Livneim Achareim Ad Olam, from where? Now we say that the Holy Neshama comes, May Eser Sviris Dikdusha. It comes from the 10 spheres of holiness, and that's a very loose translation. Sheba Arba Olam Es Abiya, which are in the 4 worlds of Atzilus, Bria, Yitzida, and Asiya. Lechol Echad Ve'yechad, Kefi Madrigosei, U'Kefi Maisav. according to each and every one, by virtue of his innate and organic level, and according to his or her efforts. And I'll explain this in a moment, but let's just finish this thought. At the very least, afilu lekal shebekalim, even a lightweight, a real spiritual lightweight, the person who barely hangs on, not a bad person, he's just a clueless, a real loser, doesn't get the whole business. Or even worse, Pesha Yisrael. Pesha Yisrael is much worse than Kal Shebekalim. Kal Shebekalim is a lightweight. He's a loser. Doesn't get it. Pesha Yisrael, he may get it very well. And he is a Pesha. He is wantonly transgressing and violating the holiness of his neshama. He's a sinner. Sinner is not a Kal Shebekalim. Nonetheless, when these two sinners of Israel are cohabit, even in the most crude fashion, there's nefesh, the nefesh, the machas, asiya, they bring forth a soul which is connected to the ultimate Jewish genome system. This genomic system would be from the Madrega Tachtena, from the lowest level, but still nonetheless, it would still be happening. All right, I need to explain this. I promise you we're going to map at the Jewish genome today. Human DNA is essentially all identical. Human DNA is human DNA. It's like fingerprints. Fingerprints is a matter... No matter what person you look at, 6 billion fingerprints, fingerprints are fingerprints. They're recognizable in a moment. Each one of them is different, far more sophisticated than barcodes. But nonetheless, it's recognizable as a fingerprint. So human DNA is recognizable. Today we can find that something's human DNA in a moment. They dig in archaeological digs, they uncover bones that are 4,000 years old. And in a matter of a brief analysis in the lab, we can know if these are animal bones or human bones. Why? Because it's human DNA. 4,000-year-old human DNA, we can know. We can even see remnants of DNA. The DNA has a specific structure. Having said that, not only not our fingerprints are not alike, none of us are alike. None of us are the same. Some of us are alike, but none of us are the same. And every one of us has a unique synergy of genetics that makes us who we are. From a physical appearance, to our emotional temperament, to a mental acuity. Every one of us is different. Every one of us. So just like you understand that from a genetic scientific perspective, that all of the mass of humanity shares a common DNA, and then you can find markers, certain markers in DNA, which will identify which part of the world a person comes from, or maybe a person's ancestry, so there's specifics within DNA, but that specifics within DNA still follows a general structure of DNA. The human DNA is the human genome is the human genome. On a spiritual level, every neshama has to come from the same structure. Every neshama has to come from the same spiritual genome. Now that spiritual genome produces myriads of neshamas. Myriads upon myriads of neshamas. And all of those neshamas will fit into a specific kind of classification. So just like within genetic science, scientists have identified several hundred classes of genes, and so whether it's European genes, Caucasian genes, African genes, South American genes, however they have a system, a methodology, and it has nothing to do with superficial look. There are people who have Jewish descent or Jewish who lived in North Africa for 3,000 years almost, and Jews who are living in Europe, and on the surface they're literally black and white, but when you do the genetic analysis, The European Jews in Northern Europe and the North African Jews had more in common between each other, even though they'd been separated for over 2,500 years, than they had with their neighbors, even though they look like the neighbors. The Danish Jews look Danish, and the Algerian Jews look Algerian or Moroccan, and yet the Algerian and Moroccan Jew has more in common with the Danish Jew than with their Moroccan neighbor. This is an amazing thing. It's really amazing. It just goes to show us that we talked about being Jewish, and we all come from the same place. Today, it's scientifically proven. Science doesn't want to talk about it because it doesn't lend itself to the narrative of science that the Torah is an old wives' tale. But this is scientifically proven. So in the same way, we can understand that there's a general human genome, and then we can identify specific genome. And people do these genetic tests today. It's fascinating to find out. They come from this part of the world or that part of the world, or three parts here and two parts there. So it is also within the framework of the spiritual system. Hashem has a spiritual system with which the world is created. And the spiritual system that's articulated in the writings of Kabbalah and really lucidly explained in the teachings of Chassidus, we know is called Esses Spheres. Esses Fides are not first and foremost the range of human reality, but rather the range of divine reality. That Hashem creates his world, and Hashem's world that he created, he first created Esser Sfidus. So the Esser Sfidus are, just to refresh and recap, we talk about Chachma, right? The ability to intuit, the power of finding new ideas of creativity, intellectual creativity that is. We talk about the idea of analysis, development, Kobina, like the word Bona. We talk about the idea of something like Das, which we would call an opinion or a bias. And those, and that comprises, and it's the way you naturally think about something, or the natural conclusion you would reach without thinking too much. That would be that's what your mind tends to go, the direction your mind tends to go. And that's really not such an intellectual thing anymore, because intellectuality in and of itself should be objective. And since here we lost objectivity, we're dealing with something which is not wholly intellectual anymore. So das, opinions are not so intellectual. There starts to be a little self in them, my opinion, your opinion, so on and so forth. Now, we leave the realm of the intellect and we go into the realm of the emotional. We have this idea of chesed. Chesed could mean giving. Chesed could mean becoming excited. Chesed could mean being engaged, involved. We have this idea of gevura, which means discipline. It could also be disengagement. It could also mean discipline. It could also mean sometimes harsh actions. There's a range of things which are called gevura. Then we have teferes, which is neither, but seems to be a balance of the two, or incorporates certain of each of those right and center and left emotion. And then we have function, how people function. So chesed-oriented people, they're going to function in a competitive way. They're very much influenced what's going on around them. Competition, is, they say, breeds excellence. Why? Because what's going on around me influences me. If this person's doing that, that person's doing that, this is the realities that are going on around me, I have to match and marry myself to that. I have to compete with that. That's a shit if I can get ahead, or maybe want to be behind. And then there's a person who could care less what's going on around them. They're totally disciplined. So they just have this... They persevere. Netzach. They're gonna get victory in the end. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter who isn't there. Pardon me, that's Hoyd. Netzach is gonna be competitive to be victorious. Hoyd is like this, the splendor of what we would call continuity. Something is exactly the same. The beauty of calligraphy. The beauty of 10,000 people marching in perfect formation. Everything's just the way it's supposed to be. Day in, day out. Hour in, hour out. Doesn't matter what's going on around them. The incredible nature of a person who's unfazed. That's the idea of Hoyd. And then we have Yesoid. And Yesoid is also, once again, incorporates from competitiveness as well as the idea of not being phased, not being influenced by others, but instead, basically, you're the one who's calling the shots. You're, instead of being influenced, you become an influencer. You're communicating, you're engaging, but you're in the driver's seat. Whereas when it comes to Netzach, oftentimes you're reactionary. But Yesoid is not reactionary at all. Anyway, I could talk to you about 2 hours about the Esser Sfiris. That's not the point. The point is that the Esser Sfiris, they represent a basic system with which everything develops. Everything develops within this frame, the system, and finally the last is Malchus, which means sovereignty, kingship, majesty, or better, maybe responsibility. So these Esser Sfiris that we're familiar with, that we talk about, the Alter Rebbe introduces it in the beginning of Tanya as the structure of the soul, is actually a reflection of a higher reality. So when God begins the creation of the world, the first emanated reality is called Atzilus. Now, whenever we talk about world, we talk about existence, we talk about something that senses independence from God. There's God, and then there's the world. And the more independence this reality feels, the further it is, in a sense, from godliness. Because when it's close to God, then it's overwhelmed by godliness. It doesn't feel itself. It just feels itself as something stemming or coming from God. So in our world, the thing which is least independent of its source is light. In general, photons are the most refined form of materiality. They're not really material. They're not dense. Photons don't take up space. But at the same time, photons are a physical reality, and today we have cameras that can actually capture. They operate more quickly than the speed of light. And they can actually capture the spreading of light. It's remarkable. And they put it on slow motion, you actually see how light spreads. Right? With technology, we actually proved many things about photonic reality that we didn't know before. But photons are particles, light particles. Only these light particles have no density whatsoever. And they have no weight. And they don't come with heat. It's a light density. So the density of light is considered to be the most rarefied form of physicality, because when you have photonic rays or photonic reality that comes from a source of light, what we call in English an effulgence, that effulgence, once the source of light is gone, the photons are gone as well. The photons never experience a disconnect. Therefore, it's a very, very refined sense of independence. On one hand, the rays of light, so the light that's on this table, that's in front of us, that's illuminating our books, comes from the source of light. But at the same time, if you turn the light bulbs off, what would happen to the light that's here? It would disappear. Now, it's true that today with technology, they could actually show you how the light would fade. They could actually show you how the light disappears. But the reality is that the photons have to keep being constantly, so to speak, energized. New photons are coming every single moment from that source of light.
You see in astronomy where a star has like disappeared, but its light is still...
Right. You're seeing the light of a star that's...
It's traveling light years.
Traveling light years, even though the source of light is no longer here. Correct. We do see that in astronomy, which is a mind-blowing concept. Right? But the thing is, in Chassidus, it says the reason that photons dissipate is because there's a density in the atmosphere that darkens the photons. So the photons are less intense. The further they travel, the more the other particles of reality darkle them. But were we to be in a clean atmosphere with no particles, then in theory the light could travel very, very far, and that's what it does in outer space. Outer space is very clean. There's no particles there. So what happens is the light can travel thousands of years, millions of light years. Now, when we talk about such a reality, that's what Atzilus is like. Is the light here? Says there's no light on the table. What are you talking about? The room is full of light now. There's no light. Of course there's light. Well, then how come when I turn the light bulb off, where does the light go? Can I put this light in a box? Can I save it for a dark night? No. Why not? Because it's always connected to its source. So there is certainly an independence called photons, but that's not an independent existence. If you had a source of water that was busy, the sprinkler system went off, chas v'shalom now, we'd all get soaked. Now, it's true, when the sprinkler system was turned off, we wouldn't be continually soaked, we'd still be wet. That's called shefa in language of Chassidus. It's ur and the shefa. So shefa is when something comes from point A to point B. There's something which is actually being conveyed. We talk about ur, talk about something which is very, very refined, and there's no density to it. So it's always connected to its source. Incidentally, if you're wondering, that's why Chassidus uses the terminology of ur all the time. In English, we use the terminology energy. But in Chassidus, we use ur, because it's the nature of ur, how refined ur is. So that's the world of Atzilus. The world of Atzilus, it's not possible for Atzilus to sense independence because it's like photons. From the world of Atzilus, we go into the world of Bria. Bria is a very, very raw form of creation. Yes, there is a sense of I am, but it cannot be articulated in a particular. It doesn't have its only substance. There's no style. So nothing is formed yet. So the world of Bria senses that very much that it is, and it is even without its source, but its being isn't defined. It doesn't really know how to define that. Ultimately, it still feels a sense of total subservience. And then we get to the world of Yetzirah, which is the world of formation. In the world of formation, we have these creatures that do have their own form. They have a specific form. So if you have a specific form, you're not godliness flowing forth. You are. I am. He says, who are you? He can define himself. Every malach of the world of Yetzirah has a very specific form. I am this. I am not that. So it's formed specifically, more independent. A step away, further away from the epicenter of the spiritual ground zero of divinity. And then finally we have the world of Asiya. Asiya means action. It's the tangible world, the actual world. In the actual world, in order for something to feel actual, it has to be distanced from God. Because if it's connected to God, it doesn't feel actual, it doesn't feel like that. So these are the four systems. To use lame terminology, subconsciousness could be like Atzilus. Actual thought could be like the concept of Bria. It could be thought about anything. It could be thought about an emotion, but awareness, like what scientists or psychologists call raw qualia. It's not defined. Not a defined thought. You know you're cold, but you haven't. The word cold hasn't come to mind yet. An awareness. But then that awareness goes from just thought. It goes into language, first mentally, but eventually you could even communicate it. And then finally, from the world of communication, we can finally then go to the concept of action. And action is the most distance, because it's true, once words leave your mouth, they can be captured today, and somebody could play them back to you, the open mic syndrome, the hot mic syndrome. But action speaks loudest. That's really something which is outside of you. You do the action, but the impact is left. So these are your four worlds. These four worlds are each comprised of Chachma, Bina, Das, Chesed, Gvura, Netzach, Chayit, Yesod, Malchus. The 10 spheres. So all the neshamas have to come either from Atzilus, which is where tzaddikim's neshamas come from. That's where they feel very close to Hashem. Or from Bria, exalted souls, but not so exalted anymore. Yetzira, a little less exalted, or the world of Asiya. Asiya is going to be action. These are the souls that feel very independent. Incidentally, there are some souls that are very spiritual. They thrive on spiritual activity. They're wonderful when it comes to meditation. They're great at prayer. They can't seem to get anything done. There are some souls that are very action-oriented. They're totally organized. Give them a job to do, it gets it done. Mesiras nefesh, sacrifice, contemplation, spirituality. They don't know what you're talking about. Leave me alone. I don't know. I don't speak that language. Bottom line, what do you want me to do? Want me to do it? I'm ready to do it. The different kinds of neshamas. In fact, we say there's mari teira, mari uvdin tovim. There are souls, the Gemara says, that excel in Torah study, that excel in academia, excel in spiritual or emotive connection. Because sometimes there is an atzilus and bria is one is intellectual, one is more emotional. Some souls pour forth in prayer. Very spiritual. They can't really understand much. They don't have a deep, profound grasp of concepts, deep concepts. And other souls, they can't understand much and they don't feel much. They're not in that whole touchy-feely thing. They can't understand. Action-oriented, get the job done. Who's better? I don't know. Depends where you look at it. Everybody has their value to play. What's better, feet or a good head? Depends. If a fire in the room, if the best headed of all, but you don't have feet, you're going to be barbecued. Why? Because you need feet now. When you need feet, you need feet. Now what happens if you have wonderful feet, you can run very fast, but now you need a brain to figure out how to get out of a situation. This is going to help. His gigantic biceps, yeah. But he's stuck in a situation. The only way to get out of this is using his brains. The guy has no brains. We're in trouble. So everything has a moment. That's why it says like Moshe Rabbeinu is the Reish Bnei Yisrael, and the Jewish people are the feet. And the feet are very effective. Why? Because it's something called transportation. You need to get from point A to point B. And guess what? Without feet, you can't get there. That's why it's a beautiful maimer from the Friedrich Rebbe about the Jewish people being likened to a grape, a vineyard. And he says there's the grapes, there's the stems, there's the leaves that protect the fruit. They're all needed. They're all part of the vineyard. The Kerem Hashem Tzvois, the vineyard of God, all the things are necessary. We each have a contribution to make. Now, this idea of a contribution to make is not only in our physical existence. It's not only from the perspective of whether we're highly intelligent or not as intelligent, whether we got sneakers or we can run real fast and get stuff done. This is all reality. It's a reflection of a higher and a deeper reality. Where does our neshama come from? The highest of neshamas will come from Chochma of Atzilus. The lowest of neshamas will come from Malchus of Asiya. You understand the range? It's 40 levels. So the Jewish genome begins with 40 different levels.
Where are we? Physical beings? Below Malchus?
No, the question is what kind of neshama you have when you're a physical being. Everybody's different. Where are we? Probably Malchus Dasiya. But that's...
The physical part has nothing to do with it.
No, it doesn't matter if you're fat or skinny or black or green or blue. That's irrelevant. The physical. This is all about neshama, so it's a spiritual reality. Now, it goes a little further. Not only do we come from one of these levels, these 40 levels... Some of us are nefesh neshamas, some of us are ruach neshamas, and some of us are neshama neshamas. Because in nefesh, ruach, neshama, there is neshama de neshama, ruach de neshama, and nefesh de neshama. And then there's another three levels. In the level of ruach, there's neshama of ruach, ruach of ruach, and then there's nefesh of ruach. And then in the third level of nefesh, we have neshama de nefesh, ruach de nefesh, and nefesh de nefesh. So what's the lowest of these nine? Nefesh de nefesh. That means now multiply the 40 in a framework of 9. Because you could have the highest neshama will be a neshama, the neshama, the atzilus. Understand? That's a Rebbe. A neshama, the neshama, the atzilus. And then we could have a nefesh, the malchus, the asiyah. You understand the Jewish, you know? I mean, whatever, to whatever level you understand it. So let's say nefesh, ruach, neshama is the idea of deep consciousness, and then we have emotions, intellectual consciousness, intellectual reality, emotions, which are in a way much smaller than the intellect is much loftier, and then we could come to the final, like the functional. Nefesh is functional. Functional consciousness, which is, by the way, the esospheres are divided that way also. Chabad chagas nehim. Chabad chagas nehi is intellect, emotion, and function. So within the framework of each of the 40 different levels, we have 9 different levels of every 40. You do the math. It's a lot of levels. That's your great Jewish genome. Here is the good news, my friends. The good news is that even if your parents were Kal Shebekalim, totally clueless, all they knew is the Jewish name and a name only. Or worse, they're the kind of Jews that they were fighting Judaism. Okay, they were the sekhtia. They were the KGB who was persecuting Jews, who was going after the tzaddikim and trying to execute them. But the fact is, when these two Jews, they produced, they came together, they produced a neshama, which is producing a pregnancy, which produces a neshama on high, he's still Jewish. Supposedly, Stalin has a Jewish grandchild.
Yeah,
of course. Supposedly, somebody told a story about that Stalin having a Jewish grandchild who's Shomer Shabbat. Stalin was like Hitler. He's a monster. Yeah, but if his son married a Jew, I guess, or he married a Jew, is what it is. That neshama can be imkar klipas, the darkest, and most depraved reality, but still a neshama.
The other way around too, though, right?
And sometimes the greatest neshamas come into the most horrible circumstances. That could also be. You never know. You understand? So even a kal shebekalim, even the simplest Jew, he's still, now you have the madrega hatachtoina shebekedushas asiya. What's the lowest madrega of kedushas asiya? The lowest madrega of kedushas asiya is nefesh, de nefesh, de malchus, de asiya.
But they don't have any testing for this.
Testing? You mean a genetic test?
A genetic test.
No. To the best of my knowledge, we don't have a genetic test. But this is why we yearn and crave closeness to tzaddikim. Because sometimes tzaddikim have x-ray vision, and they can see what your neshama is really all about, and that's they can give you guidance. That's why it says in Yom Yom that the first yichidus was according to the basic structure of the neshama.
Can souls like attach two souls to? And
There is this idea of attaching yourself to an iCloud. There is such a concept where a soul can be further elevated. You can get a massive upgrade, which you didn't start with. You know, today your iPhone could have like a, even though it's an iPhone 2, you could today attach a pack and turn it into like an iPhone 7. The problem is it looks like the old-fashioned cell phones. But you could, in theory, upgrade something. So a lone neshama actually could reach for a higher madrega. The bottom line is, the Avos gave every single one of us these neshamas. Because we are descended genetically, physically, from Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah, we all have a neshama. Which is neshama? How high? How low? That's another story. But we're still in the building. You're still part of that genome. As long as you're part of that genome, whether the person is a pygmy or a person's a giant, he's still part of human DNA. It still has the human DNA system. Whether the person is dumb as an ox, whether the person is the most brilliant Einstein, he's still part of human genome. Whether the person has high-functioning emotion, incredibly sensitive emotions, where they're compassionate and sensitive and they know everything that's going on around them, or a person is totally autistic and cannot relate to people at all. Nebuch lives in a totally locked-up world, doesn't understand anybody around them, they still have the human DNA. They still function. They're animals. They're still a human being.
So what's the difference between the Jewish and the non-Jewish?
This neshama that we just talked about, this is the mapping out of the Jewish genome. This is a Yiddish neshama.
What about we're here to perfect our neshama? So like, you know, if we did a good job, the neshama we started with shouldn't be the same neshama that at the end.
Well, that's the goal is that the neshama shouldn't be the way it came down. The neshama should be further enhanced. But that's why the Alter Rebbe started this off. L'kol echad yechad kifi madregasay. Madrega is a level. The level. And he said, kifi ma'isav. Kifi ma'isav is in accordance with his actions. That means if we take certain actions or we do things, and I gave you a few stories, that's why I told you those stories of these people. Bar Katsutsi was the biggest lowlife. A man who utilized his wealth in order to commit adultery. But in the end, because he made this decision in the last minute not to do the wrong thing, he elevated his neshama in a remarkable way. So people can say, why did God give me this terrible test? Why did God give me these terrible cravings? Why did God give me these terrible lusts? What's the answer? Hashem wants you to elevate your neshama. Because you ended up with a neshama which is Pesha Yisrael potential. Kal Shebekalim. A neshama, nefesh, the nefesh, the machos, the atzilus. The asiyah. How could you elevate your neshama? So the Eibishter gave you this enormous test, and it's not fair, and you're angry, but that's because you're lacking faith. If we have more faith, you say, you know why Hashem gave me this enormous test? Because He wants me to be able to lift my neshama out of the lowest level and to take it up a few notches. And if I wouldn't, Gamzul Teva, if I wouldn't have this challenge, if I wouldn't have this issue, if I wouldn't have, I would never do that. So that's how we have to look at life.
So we're not. So it's not in stone. I mean, you could.
You're right. It's not in stone. The Alter Rebbe said that right in the beginning. Kifi madregasei u kifi maisav. According to his madrega and according to his actions. You're right. It is not in stone.
That's why we're here.
It is not in stone. And the perfect example is Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov didn't have it. He didn't have it. Esav had it. At least some levels of it.
He acquired it.
He acquired it. He acquired it. Yaakov is the quintessential Jew.
But if your soul comes from one place, how can it change where it comes from?
Oh, because it's in the system. That's why the whole point is. It's in the system.
Yaakov, when he was when they passed by place of study, he was happy.
He was a very sensitive soul. Yaakov was extremely spiritually sensitive. But he didn't have the koyach to rise out of the ashes of Auschwitz and to rebuild Yiddishkeit. He didn't have tenacity. He didn't have courage. He couldn't think outside the box. He's a goody two-shoes. He could never deal with realities that aren't perfect. Esav, now you're talking. He's a zhulik. He's a tough guy. He could deal with whatever comes his way. Only when Yaakov synthesizes Esav-like qualities and he steals, so to speak, surreptitiously, snatches the blessings, then Yitzchak says, God, baruch here. Oh, now we're talking. So you can. Oh, if you can, then you should.
It's like eugenics. In your lifetime, you could affect your DNA by your behavior.
Yes, a person could affect the DNA. Circumstances could affect the DNA. 100%. Even, and it could even be passed on.
Yeah.
Epigenetics.
Yeah.
That's all.
Rabbi, I wanted to ask about physical DNA. How come the Jews, Danish Jews look like Danish people, and somewhere else, like in Israel, some Jews look like Arabs?
Right, right. Or Ethiopian Jews look totally black. The answer is... Yeah. The answer is that, and this is not really my field, this is the field of genetic science, but the answer is that there's two levels of genetics, at least. This is gross oversimplification. If there's any genetic scientists out there watching, they're probably laughing at me now. But basically, there is the genetic markers that change superficial reality, and then there's the inherent genetic markers. We talk about the fact that there's more in common between the Ethiopian Jew and the Danish Jew, even though one is blonde and white as snow, and the other is black as ebony. It's because underneath the surface of the epigenetics, the deeper genetics are essentially the same operating principles or operating, and that can't be changed. That's the point. There's certain genetic markers that can be modified and changed, and certain genetic markers that can't be. And therefore, incidentally, the neshama, that's a nefesh, the nefesh, the malchus, the asiya, always remains to some degree a nefesh, the malchus, the asiya. He always has this extra challenge.
Somebody mentioned to me that, say, Jews start looking from the place where they come from.
Because, no question.
Because they, over generations.
But it's superficial.
These are epigenetic changes. It's true. They're epigenetic changes. They're like the people from Russia have higher cheekbones or greater bone density.
Skin color.
Trust me, my grandparents look Russian. I'm so not Russian.
Like your husband and wife start to look like each other after.
It could be. It could be.
It's like to look like their dogs, you know?
Okay. Anyway, before we go down there, bottom line is you must know you have a magnificent soul that's plugged into a magnificent system and you are capable of extraordinary things. You just have to start working on actualizing it.